You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Paul Bloom.
Hello, Robert Wright. How are you?
I am just kind of in heaven. I got to say, I'm very happy. Let me introduce this first, and I'll explain why. So I'm Robert Wright, editor-in-chief of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Paul Bloom, editor-in-chief of the Falsely Modest Newsletter. Small Potatoes, a world-famous psychologist in what is for now a sovereign nation, Canada. Enjoy that while it lasts. But if you want to know, Paul, why I'm so delighted, this week we saw you. I've got everybody out there on tenterhooks. Okay, you're not alone. And I'm going to let the suspense build, frankly. Okay, now. So both Donald Trump and Elon Musk staged fairly abject surrenders this week. Let's start with Musk. Paul, you know, nothing cheers me up quite like a headline like this. You see that? What does that say? See that?
Tesla is not doing well. Drops of 71% in profits.
71%. And on the earnings call, where Musk kind of explained to his stockholders what was going on, he basically acknowledged that his whole foray into politics had been bad for Tesla.
Hard not to deny that.
Well, for Musk, I mean, you know, he's pretty good at denial. In fact, here's a good example. He says, as for why there have been protesters at Tesla showrooms, he says, as the New York Times report, that they were conducted by people who stood to lose government handouts because of his work with the Trump administration. Musk says, quote, "The real reason is that those who are receiving the waste and fraud wish it to continue." Now, I don't doubt that some of these protesters, to beef up the protests, appeal to people who worried about losing, I don't know, Medicaid or something. But it's a little deeper than that, Elon. Your problem is deeper than that. We don't like you. Okay. And, you know, I wish his surrender were being staged on more fronts than the political one. I mean, he basically said on the earnings call, you know, I'm not going to be so involved in Doge and blah, blah, blah. It has been bad for Tesla. You know, and sadly, the work of Doge will continue. And so I would like the retreat to be more all encompassing. But I do think it would be a bad sign, like if a billionaire can just barge into the political limelight, do a couple of Heil Hitler salutes, declare himself co-president, be an even bigger asshole than our actual president, and like have that succeed. And it didn't succeed. We don't like you.
I do not think that Elon Musk was a bigger asshole than Donald Trump, but everything else I get.
Yeah, I may have been overstating the case. It's quite a claim, isn't it?
It is quite a claim.
In vibe, because he doesn't read a room the way Trump does.
Yes.
So he more often comes off, just in terms of vibe, as this guy you don't like, I think. Of course, I'm looking at it from the perspective of a guy who doesn't like Elon Musk, granted, but I wasn't always like that. I wasn't.
Me neither.
We used to be like
I was a defender of Musk.
Yeah.
And in fact, I still think there's a case to be made for colonizing Mars. He should get off of this Doge crap, off of X, spend more of his time making us an interplanetary species.
But I think it's all part of the Mars plan in his head.
I know.
So as for Trump, he basically has implicitly acknowledged that this whole tariff thing has just been egregiously mismanaged. He's now saying, yeah, we're going to lower the tariffs on China. It's fine. We love China. Meanwhile, China is like saying, I don't know. We haven't started talking. We're in no hurry. And I think maybe one reason is there was another headline in the New York Times. See all these pictures of robots, Paul, on the front page of the physical New York Times?
Yes, you're doing a lot of this this video stuff. I'm very impressed.
You don't want to let your subscription to the physical New York Times go to waste. And anyway, the headline
people
is
people listening to this over you know, podcasts.
Well, that's why I'm about to read the headline.
Go ahead.
You know, I'm old enough to remember the days of you know, live radio shows, Paul. Not quite actually, but I've heard some of them. Anyway, I try to keep that tradition alive and be as descriptive as possible. The headline is Army of Robots Give China Edge in Trade War. Meanwhile, on the same day, the New York Times ran a story where Elon Musk said, you know, our robotics program, the Optimus robot that Elon Musk is developing, may be slowed because China, in retaliating against Trump's tariffs, put limits on the export of some rare earth minerals and I think some actual magnets already containing them. But in any event, I think China's demonstrated that it has at least as much leverage as Trump.
Yeah.
Trump is flailing. I love to see it. So that's why I'm happy. I am a little worried, though, that the more impotent Trump looks, the worse it will be for Prime Minister Carney in your nation as he heads into this election, right? Because he thrives on combat with Trump, the menace to the South, right? And when is the election? It's like any
on the 28th. Like
28th. It's like it's 4 days away.
Apparently,
it's so timely.
Yeah. I was reading CBC News this morning, as one does, Canadian. Apparently Trump did make some more remarks about Canada. He repeated his 51st state thing. He said,
did he?
Yes, he said he might well sanction us with further bigger and better tariffs. He said, we don't need Canada's cars. We don't need Canada's oil. He said he wasn't going to get involved in the election, but he said he had some excellent conversations with our new prime minister, Mark Carney.
If you want to emphasize that theme, fine. But I'm not even sure that's smart. I mean, none of this makes sense. There is this international league of aspiring authoritarians, and in some cases authoritarians, that Trump seems to belong to, and he seems to want to nurture that and put more of them in power. Why would it be so stupid as to heighten the tension with Canada on the eve of this election when, in theory, I mean, not that your conservative candidate is an authoritarian, but he's more Trumpist than the liberal, right? Why isn't Trump helping him?
I mean, apparently, Pierre Poilievre, the conservative candidate, who was several months ago was a huge lead, like 99% in betting markets. And I'm kicking myself for not, you know, basically ensuring my tremendous wealth by putting all my money in the betting markets. Mm-hmm. He was very much in the Trumpian mold. And then Trump became the most hated man in Canada. And then Poilievre was in a situation. And in fact, how Poilievre responded was, and this is an answer to your question, Poilievre responded by, I think, saying some somewhat negative things about Trump. And Trump, I don't know if you've absorbed this, but he's actually sometimes of a sensitive, prickly sort. So
I hadn't noticed that.
So in some press conference, I said, well, I've heard this Poilievre guy has said some bad things about our beloved president. You know, maybe the liberals should win. I think I could talk to them. This is what Trump said. So I don't know what Trump wants. Trump might simply want Mark Carney to win because Mark Carney has been nicer to Trump than Pierre Poilievre.
But wait, that could be brilliant reverse psychology. He's making himself the enemy of the conservative so that that will endear Canadians to the conservative. This is genius. It just isn't consistent with all the other stuff Trump is doing, which doesn't seem so brilliant if his goal is to help the conservative.
It's 14-dimensional chess. We'll only got it.
The guy is like, it's like they ask, when will superintelligence arrive? Folks, it's here. It's in the White House.
Yudkowsky once said that dealing with a super intelligent AI is like asking a novice chess player, you know, how will, you know, Bobby Fischer beat me playing chess? You know, well, he's just going to destroy you. You have no idea what's going to happen. And there we see the genius of Donald Trump. But did you see the Canadian leaders debate of last week?
You know, I missed it. There was something else going on that night. I don't remember what it was, but it seemed more interesting.
I guess you didn't see the French language debate the previous night. You missed them both.
No, sadly, I was also engaged that evening by something I don't recall. Yeah.
So the debate was very interesting. It was between the four, as these things are, between the four major leaders, the Liberals, Conservative, NDP, and Bloc Québécois. And there's two things I want to say relevant to this. One thing is, it was all about Trump. I think the first question is, how are you going to deal with Donald Trump, with the threat of Donald Trump? And Trump came out continuously in the discussions. And in some way, this is an election. We're trying to choose the guy who's best equipped to face up to Donald Trump. Nothing more complicated. The second thing I want to, and this is like a challenge to the American system, political system. There was a part towards the end of the debate where each of the participants got to choose another person and ask them a question. So all of the other three chose Mark Carney, the liberal guy, because he's the leader. He's actually favored to win a majority government. And the first two questions were basically, you know, how can you stomach lying to the Canadian people for so long? That sort of question. But the guy, Yves-François Blanchet, the Bloc Québécois guy, says, why have you not met with me? I've asked you to meet with me, and you seem to have no time for this. And this is an insult. It's an insult to Quebec, and it's an insult to our parliamentary system. The idea being a parliament tends to work, because we have more than one party, by collaboration. If it's a minority government, it's essential. You need to team up with another party. Even if it's a majority government, to get legislation through, you might have to team up. And much more so than in the States, is encourages that sort of collaboration, that sort of a cognitive empathy, where you understand where your other side's coming from, you work with them, you have a common cause. You might find that the most conservative party is connecting with the Green Party or the NDP. Actually, it's something very sweetly Canadian, very, very an advantage of parliamentary systems rather than the sort of winner-take-all system that you Yankees have.
Well, there's a sense in which you guys are winner-take-all, but in which parliamentary systems are winner-take-all, because whoever is leading the country has a majority in the legislature. So they have more power, and that's one virtue of the system. Whether through coalition or through party dominance, they have the majority in the legislature. I like that part. But anyway, what was the reply to this challenging question?
Oh, it was you know, Carney.
Thank you, I don't have time. I don't have time for frogs kind of thing.
I don't give a shit about Quebec. No, I don't think Carney was going to go that route. Carney's been actually Quebec's been very hard hit by the tariffs. And and so Carney said, expressed his tremendous support for Quebec and the Quebec government. The Bloc Québécois is an interesting institution which has no analogy anywhere in the States or most anywhere, where they only run
candidates. Is it a separatist party?
I actually don't know. I know that they have separatist sympathies. I don't think right now their goal is separatism, but they only run in Quebec. So the Bloc Québécois, in principle, cannot win the government, but they can be play an important role, be in a minority government.
Well, was this, and so they are neither liberal nor conservative. They're their own thing.
They're their own thing.
And they might be willing to partner with either as part of a majority coalition.
Yeah. Their own thing, and it's actually interesting where, you know, the conservatives are conservative and some of the same, you know, like Pierre Poilievre is against DEI, wants to shut down DEI in favor of crypto, wants to lower taxes, you know, conservative guy. Mark Carney's more of a liberal guy. The NDP is more liberal than they are, wants to increase unemployment insurance, wants to have all post-secondary education free. But the Bloc Québécois is, they care about Quebec. They're a regional party. Which is, their politics are probably pretty liberal, but they just care about Quebec. And so it's an unusual dynamic.
Yeah, the secession movement was stronger there at a time. I wrote a column for the New Republic like decades ago called Microturfs. There was then this novel called Microsurfs that was popular. And it was about how information technology can actually help divide into tribes, because that was when like cable TV had I think created more like language specific TV in various places, including Quebec. This was before the internet, which of course in some ways deepened the trend. But so I have a question and a prediction. The question is, when people vote, are they actually literally voting for Carney if they don't live in his district? Or they're technically voting for the local candidate who belongs to his party. And then if the party wins, he wins.
That's right.
So I guess the polling then is a little more challenging. I'll tell you what my prediction was going to be. My prediction was going to be, if he's not up by at least 3 points in the polls, he's going to lose. Because I think, you know, in America, Trump voters for a while were less willing to say to pollsters that they're voting for Trump, apparently. So there was this undercounting of them. I would think that right now, as strong as the nationalist sentiment against Trump is, and to some extent, therefore, against his conservative counterpart, that people might be reluctant to say that they're voting for. But in any event, that's complicated by the fact that that isn't, strictly speaking, the polling question anyway.
That's right. That's right. That's right. So it's 343 polling questions. And then you just do the math.
Yeah. Okay. So kind of never mind. So that problem doesn't afflict polling in Canada, I guess, quite
well,
in the same way.
I mean, you know, when I vote, I don't even know the MP in my neighborhood. I'm going to vote for the leader I think is best, which is, you know, Mark Carney.
So you vote for the party.
I'm going to vote liberal. I mean, you know, just.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not crazy. I'm not going to vote for NDP or Green, but I'm not going to vote for the Conservative.
And that's probably the way pollsters ask the question, right?
Yeah. I mean, for a while, Poilievre was very appealing in certain ways. And like a lot of Canadians, I had serious fatigue about Trudeau. But one reason why, your analysis makes sense, but one reason, a couple reasons go against it. One reason is all of the focus was on Trudeau. And maybe people didn't like Trudeau, but be uncomfortable saying so. But now you got a new guy, Carney. And then the second thing is, Carney is in some ways very conservative. He's a banker. It's very boring watching him talk. He talks slowly and thoughtfully. He has no charisma, he has no energy. And it's very appealing in a Canadian sort of way. And he stole many of the conservatives' ideas. The conservatives have been pushing to remove an unpopular tax, carbon tax. He removed it. And so, conservatives appear probably was kind of pissed off at that, made a few remarks about you're stealing our best ideas. But, you know, so he's a very conservative, liberal guy. And none of this election, I think, especially turns on social issues. There weren't even questions of, well, what's their definition of a woman? What do you think of trans people? And it's none of that bullshit. It's all like, what are you going to do with tariffs?
Okay. So it's a vibe election, as we see.
We should make this podcast all Canadian all the time.
I think that would do wonders for our ratings. But no, this week is the week when, like I said last week, man, I've got the market cornered on Canadian psychologists in the podcast world. And at a time like this, whoa, you hit the jackpot. Because Canada's suddenly in the news. We're about to conquer it. And plus, you're having this election.
Many have called this the Canadian century.
How many? Where do they live?
I have called it the Canadian century at times.
Now, you know where I think that came from? Was it Henry Luce who called the 20th century the American century?
I think so. And it was not wrong.
Alex Gibney did a documentary decades ago on public TV called The Pacific Century, I think, about the rise of kind of Asia as a force. And I guess he was talking about next century, this century, in other words. But the thing aired in the late 20th. Oh, well. So where do we go from here, Paul? You've written a lot of
topics.
Yeah, your falsely modest newsletter, Small Potatoes, has been full of provocative things. One of them was on evil. One of them was on, and I could connect this thing that Musk said to that, but. But also, oh, you had one at AI Love.
Yeah, and right? Also, I'm going to talk a bit just about embryo selection, because I had one called...
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, let's talk about that. By the way, did you see that? One of the things Trump did, there's a woman who came through customs in the U.S. I mean, among the immigrants who I guess have run afoul of Trump is this woman who came in with frog embryos and failed to declare them. I mean, I would declare. I declare like apples,
on your
oranges.
Thing
I fill those, you know. So I would. I definitely
alcohol, liquor, frog embryos.
Well, this comes under I would think this probably comes under the agricultural rubric, the one that makes you declare any fruits or vegetables or animals. I think.
I guess so. It's an interesting metaphysical question where frog embryos fit.
Anyway,
why was she carrying frog embryos?
She is an actual researcher, and I think some senior person had asked her to do it, and I believe maybe she had even, like, at the last minute texted, should I declare these or what? So it was for legitimate research. It wasn't, like, part of a, you know, I mean, I'm sure there are terrorist plots to spawn mutant frogs in the U.S., and I worry about that, but this was not that.
So what happened to her?
I haven't checked up. And I don't know if she was in a category that would make Trump want the excuse to deport her. I don't know how this is playing out. Like, I don't know if she's Muslim or something, but.
No, we may have spoken about this before, but I don't know how much of a big news story this is from an American perspective, but from a Canadian perspective, and I think a foreign perspective, just more generally, that what's been happening at the U.S. border is terrifying people. Just these stories of people who come in and they are Muslim, they're dark skinned, maybe they had posts that were critical of Trump. Maybe their visas are simply complicated. Like they had a temporary visa in the States to work there. Then they moved before everything all legal, but complicated. And then this awful stuff happening. I mean, not to say sent to El Salvador, but put in cells and so on. And I think statistically, these are very infrequent. You know, one in 100,000, maybe one in a million. A lot of people cross these borders, but they're very salient. And I know a lot of people who are just don't want to cross the U.S. into U.S. border. And I bet from Trump's point of view, that's fine. That's an intended.
Well, the part of it that will get his attention is it hurting the tourist industry. He is responsive to commercial. I mean, the reason he's retreating on tariffs is because of, you know, partly the stock market, but I think in particular the bond market. Interest rates were doing a weirder thing than stocks were doing in a way. Treasury rates, and that means it's like because we are so in debt as a government, that means it's going to cost us more to run the government. And it was just like aberrant. It was a weird pattern that suggested we were starting to be thought of as like a not a developed nation almost. And so Trump, you know, James Carville, I think, who said, if he could be reincarnated, he'd want to be reincarnated as the bond market, because then you can intimidate everyone. And politicians do pay attention to it. But anyway, the commercial blowback gets his attention. But you're right. People are scared. I saw a piece today about how foreign students on campuses are asking campus newspapers to go back and delete op-eds they wrote, you know, like 3 years ago. And meanwhile, this has spread beyond immigrants. The the so-called war on anti-Semitism, which some people think looks more like a war on critics of Israel, but apparently, according to the thing I saw yesterday, Trump is like NIH scientists will lose their grants if they support a boycott of Israel. Now this is, there are a bunch of, most American states have now passed this kind of legislation, even though you would think it won't ultimately survive court challenge, although I don't know what's taken so long in the court challenge front, because boycotts have been deemed a protected form of expression by the Supreme Court during the civil rights era. But that's kind of new. That's like, these are just regular American citizens. And of course, it has been done at the state level, but this is a federal government policing speech, in effect. You're not allowed to say, I support a boycott. You are allowed to say you support a boycott of America or Canada still. You'll be happy to know. But So, I don't know.
And there's this this terror, you know, ripping through the land about entering the states, about speaking out on Israel, speaking on other controversies. And on the one hand, I think it's what Trump wants. I mean, Trump wants people to be afraid before they speak in certain ways. Maybe he wants to have a sort of committed estrangement from other countries of the world. But he doesn't want businesses to collapse. He's not irrational in that sense. And so, and this is going to hurt. I imagine it's going to hurt a tourist business in the States.
Yeah. I had an Indian political scientist on my podcast this week who ran afoul of Modi because he was critical of Modi, Prime Minister Modi. And he wound up resigning first as an administrator at the university, and then he just left the university. And, you know, he said the way it works is they don't have to punish that many people to send the message that inhibits speech. You know, Modi, Trump, whoever.
Yep. I think it's going to be more at this rate. It's just business as usual in the States, where academics are punished. Lawyers are punished. And, you know, and it's, I think it's a disgrace how many law firms have folded Trump, really, in you know, promising, oh, we'll give you tons of money for your causes. We will not represent your enemies.
Yeah.
And not good, man.
It's a collective action problem. But it could be good for Canada. I mean, really, some professors have already left, not like, you know, high commercial value professors like, AI people or molecular biologists, so far as I know, but you've got Timothy Snyder now. Congratulations.
Timothy Snyder. I was just, he's now in Toronto. Jason Stanley, the Yale philosopher.
Congratulations. I got to say, if I had to pick a couple that I'd be willing to let go, they might be at the top of my list. I don't know that much about Jason Stanley, but he just seems, I don't know. What is his shtick? What is he famous for?
He does both political stuff. He wrote a super critical of Trump and viewing this as a fascist movement.
Well, Snyder's too, needless to say.
And Snyder's too, very much. But also Jason's done some more technical stuff on philosophy and pragmatics and communication. And, you know,
are these guys at your, they're not at your college, are they at U of T?
They are now both at U of T.
Really? They're your colleagues. Congratulations. I take back everything I said about both of them. I think they're fine Canadians.
We are as a university. In fact, this is one of the things that Carney, the Liberal Party's promise, was to use the federal government to devote some amount of money, not very much, like $100 million, to poach Americans. And U of T is actually, you know, I don't want to divulge too much, but in my department itself may be involved in sort of seeking out high profile, brilliant American psychologists and just kind of pulling them over the border.
Maybe in overtime, you'll give us just a little clue.
That
paid subscribers.
Some people you may know.
Privy to. And you know, U of T is already like an AI magnet by virtue of having Jeffrey Hinton there.
Jeffrey Hinton.
Another esteemed colleague of yours.
Yes.
So, yeah.
It's amazing.
And you know,
nice
by
city.
The way,
yeah.
By the way, Chinese scientists and maybe to some extent Chinese Americans, I don't know, feel under threat. Some of them, and there's a lot of them in AI, so you guys could really clean up.
Yeah, that's the hope. And Toronto is one of the great cities, or Vancouver is another place that's making moves. And it's these are good places to settle in. House prices are a bit high, but otherwise, winters are rough. Otherwise, very nice.
So did you notice how I thwarted your attempt to turn us to like a non-political target with that frog embryo segue that got us off on this thing where when you wanted to talk about embryo selection?
I know the thing is I'm so used to be very down on Canada, but I think, and maybe it's me, maybe it's events, but now you're very pro Canada. You're starting to see
I've always been pro. I love that the Canadian people are fine people. They are fine people. And they skate to where the puck is going rather than where it is. That's my favorite thing about
that. That is true of Canada. And also,
I always skate to where it is, and it just doesn't work.
The motto as a country now seems to be elbows up, which is a fighting.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. See, Trump is really what the Canadians needed. Because, I mean, I don't want to say there was a deficiency before Trump, but you know what I mean. You were a little on the excessively nice side. Do you remember those days?
I do remember those days. And also, Quebec, which has no love for Canada traditionally, this is the standard, you know, aliens attack and all the countries of the world get together.
Totally.
Well, an alien has attacked Canada and the provinces, which are very disparate in their interests, have combined to be together against a common enemy. And
it's an alien superintelligence, as we said.
So as long as he doesn't actually come and kill us all or destroy our economy, this could be a plus.
Someday you're going to thank Donald Trump for stiffening the Canadian spine, Paul.
Somebody had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So embryos. I wrote a piece where I talked about a New York Times article on embryo selection. And
yeah,
well, this may be a moral blind spot. Here and if it is, I'm
I think
sure
it is.
Are.
I read your piece. I think it is a moral blind spot.
Good. I want to hear you. So in my piece, I talked about what a bioethicist was saying, and I disagreed with it. But here's the gist: embryo selection is when you look at embryos, you have to in the course of IVF, you have to implant some and not others. So typically, just do it random. But instead of doing it random, you test them, And this is currently done because you want to not implant ones which have, you know, cystic fibrosis or Down syndrome, whatever. You just do basic, serious chromosomal abnormalities. There are claims that you can use more subtle, polygenetic tests to see, to select for intelligence, kindness, low chance of getting schizophrenia, low chance of getting breast cancer and stuff like that. I'm very skeptical about how useful these methods are right now. So this isn't just in practice. But suppose they work. I don't understand why people get so upset about the prospect. And here's how I put it. And then
This is your moral blind spot. I'm not sure it's just a blind spot, but go ahead and exhibit it.
Here's how I put it. You know, people say, oh my God, rich people are going to use this to select for intelligent kids. But suppose rich people, as they do, arrange for your kids that go to good schools with small class sizes, benefit from private tutoring and all sorts of stuff. And that makes them smarter. I'm a nativist, but I think that sort of environment will think have a difference. How is that any different? To me, it's not different at all. So I don't see what the fuss is about.
No, but it is different.
Go ahead.
Well, one scenario, and by the way, this is a real thing. Elon Musk has used this company that does this embryo selection thing. And apparently, although they don't do it in their public advertising, they do spread the word that they know how to do things that will increase the chances that your child has a high IQ. Now, like you, I don't know whether that's true, but I'll bet you Musk is willing to give it a shot. He's known for doing experiments on a large scale and then seeing which part doesn't work. I think he's really done this. But the answer to your question is one of these things, the actual genetic selection, could lead to a future in which you have a clearly genetically stratified society, eventually, even to the point of it looking like two different species. And so the ruling class is this, intellectually and physically stronger species that rules over the other. Whereas private schools, and I'm not wild, I'm also not wild about disparities in education between economic classes, but they are less horrifying scenarios they can lead to. And these are like qualitatively different things, it seems to me. So now you can argue it either way, because, it's a very challenging issue, not just morally, but in terms of regulatory questions. But it does seem to me people aren't confused in seeing a clear distinction and saying, no, I'm okay with one, but I'm not okay with the other.
And the reason why the difference would be because the genetic thing is in some sense long lasting. It goes on to the next generation.
Yeah. And, well, not only that, but it will build on itself. Not only that, but we probably aren't going to have these qualitatively momentous shifts in pedagogy technique. Whereas it is reasonable to expect, especially with AI starting to accelerate science, as it's just about to start to do, we could have a scenario where, yeah, you can not just select the embryo that looks most favorable, but actually get in and edit the stuff and, yeah, create a super smart person. Now, you'll have to kind of experiment to find out what deficiencies may accompany selecting for a given positive trait. But, yeah, you could wind up. It's not a joke to say you could wind up with what looks like a distinct, like, subspecies or something, and that is ruling the other species.
Yeah, my moral blind spot, if it's a moral blind spot, extends to the sort of selection stuff that we're doing now. So you get a dozen embryos, and you choose the one that's less likely to get schizophrenia, that's more likely to be smart, maybe tall, cheerful. I'm not entirely on board to creating a super race of humans, which are, 10 feet tall, tremendous intelligence, unbearable strength, and they live for 500 years.
Paul is, quote, not entirely on board. Okay.
I'm on the, well, it actually depends on the trait. So if it turns out rich people have a way genetically to make sure kids don't get schizophrenia or dementia or brain cancer, I'm enough of a utilitarian to say, well, it would be nice if everybody could do it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to begrudge you probably have so many paid subscribers. Your right to generate offspring that don't get schizophrenia just because I don't have the capacity to do so. It's a better world.
Another distinction these people are making that you're not making, and this is, it's a fuzzier distinction than it may sound like, but it's not totally without merit, is between preventing deficiencies and enhancing. Okay.
Yeah.
So they would say, look, there's a difference between preventing cancer mm-hmm. or even preventing Down syndrome and yep. somebody who would have had a kid with an IQ of 130 having one with one of 160. Yeah. That's qualitatively, you know, and it's not that hard to make the distinction between preventing your kid from being way below average in some respect,
yeah.
as you deem. Of course, you know, I'm all for whatever neurodiversity and whatever. I'm not making judgments about people with Down syndrome or anything, but a lot of parents would say they'd rather not have a child who's you know, IQ is well below average. And so there is a fairly clear difference. Now, of course, if
it's not that clear. It's not that clear. I mean, if the average IQ turns out to be 120 at a certain point.
Right.
Within a community.
If each generation you shave off the bottom 10%, slowly the average rises.
Yeah.
That's true. But the average... Well, anyway, I don't think these people are crazy to make the two distinctions I've made between a genetically stratified future and some kind of culturally stratified future. And let's face it, we have a culturally stratified present.
We're living in a culturally stratified future.
But I don't think that's a crazy distinction. And I don't think the one I've just outlined is a crazy distinction. Most distinctions become a little elusive when you try to pin them down, but that doesn't mean they're without intellectual merit.
Well, there's another distinction I would make, which I really do worry about, which is sometimes individual choices, and this could happen culturally, but it also happens genetically, can have negative externalities, can make things worse as a whole. So, so gender selection is an obvious choice, which is, you know,
right.
In one way, if somebody says, look, I really want to have a boy, I say, well, I don't care, have a boy, that's good for you. And we could do that right now, of course. But if you're in a population and 90% of people choose to have boys, that's not good for society as a whole. People tend to want tall boys because boys who are tall do better in life and so on. And I might feel like, well, whatever. But if soon the average height for a man is 7 feet tall, then it puts pressure on everybody else to have a tall kid because you don't want to have the shortest kid, a mere 6.5 foot kid.
Right.
That's not good. It's not good to raise a race of humongously gigantic people.
Well, you could make the same case about, to the extent that intelligence is an instrument you use to gain social status, you know, social status is a, what's the term? Anyway, it's a zero-sum contest, the race for social status. And so, you know, it's kind of a waste of resources at the societal level in a certain sense. Now, there are other purposes of intelligence.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, to the extent that an asset is cultivated for the purpose of status pursuit or anything that is a positional good, that's the term. You know, in other words, where its value depends entirely on its comparison with the other person's good, that's not a good use of societal resources at the societal level for everyone to be, because there's no net benefit. It's all relative.
Okay. I think you're right that intelligence is a positional good. You know, if you have a brilliant kid, your kid will do better than my kid. Puts pressure on me to have a brilliant kid too. But it's not only a positional good.
I agree.
It's also a net positive. If I heard...
Well, I don't know about that, but it's not just positional. The goal.
I think if I heard that, I don't know, there's something going on so that the residents of California are getting a special drug that will make their kids much smarter, but I don't have access to it for my kids, I still say, that's fantastic. The world's going to be better off with more smart people. There's so much evidence that intelligence is linked to all sorts of good things. More self-control, more kindness, more compassion for people. And simply being smart is good, because the world, we are faced with difficult problems, and it's better to be smart than to be less smart.
I mean, I think some of those, I think it's hard to control your variables with some of those correlations. I mean,
maybe, but wouldn't you want a world with, like, if it's purely a positional good, then mm-hmm. making everybody in the world smart means nothing. There's equally kicking up everybody's IQ by 20 points, way to put it, means nothing. We're all in the same position relative to each other.
Increasing average IQ.
I would hit that button right away.
That would not be my priority at all.
Really?
You know who's really smart? Elon Musk. That's great. Yeah? That's great. He's doing a fucking world of good.
Not every smart person does good in the world.
No, and all these smart people in Silicon Valley right now are, not all of them, but many of them are like, probably accelerating technological advance at a rate that will prove deeply problematic. That's my view with the AI revolution. And most of them are now recommending, for reasons I don't completely understand, that we antagonize China as deeply as, well, not as deeply as possible, but they are China hawks. And this combination, rapid AI evolution and like deep hostility between the US and China, folks, I guarantee you it's the simplest recipe for ruining the whole planet, including you and your offspring.
And these are
super smart people.
And neither one of us is smart enough to see the upside.
Actually, you know, that's not my view.
I didn't think so. I mean, look, I've heard you talk about policy, foreign policy, domestic policy. And basically, one way of putting your view is we should be smarter. We should be less visceral, less...
No, it's not a question of intelligence. That's my point. These people are intelligent.
The cognitive empathy that you so adore...
That's it.
Is nothing but a form of intelligence. It is very...
I don't think so. It's very cognitively
hard to take the point of view of another person.
Okay, but Paul, we should go into overtime. I mean, this is getting heated. It could get ugly. So
I remember from a month ago, I said something which I do regret. So
was it in overtime?
The dog reference?
Oh, when you compared me to a visually impaired dog? I barely remember it. It's not like I harbor grievances. I'm not the kind. I'm glad you reminded me. I had forgotten you called me a visually impaired dog.
I did, but there was a context for it where it's not as bad as it sounds.
Yeah.
Before we go into overtime, by the way, the last overtime, you regular viewers will remember, we talked about this right before, Bob had a prediction about White Lotus. In this overtime, we will discuss the prediction and talk about how well it has fared.
There's controversy over this. Paul thinks that the prediction was flatly false. And I just think that is way too simple a view. And frankly, not a very sophisticated one, Paul. I mean, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say that, but
that's okay.
It's a really dumb thing for you to say. Overtime. So if you're a paid subscriber, either Small Potatoes or the Non-Zero newsletter. And by the way, only one of those is falsely modest. One is actually
modest. I wish I had a brand like Non-Zero.
That's the actual modest one.
No, I get it.
Because like zero, that's the most self-esteem we can muster. It's like, well, we're not quite zero, but pretty close. That's true modesty. For Small Potatoes is like, oh gosh, I'm just this famous psychologist.
Yeah. It does have a false modest tone to it. Although the story, the name has an origin story. You go to the first Substack I wrote.
You mean the theft from the rabbi story, or is this different?
It's different from the theft from the rabbi story.
You know, I like the fact that that reference drives you genuinely crazy. Like, that's your thing. You call me a visually impaired dog. That is what I should retaliate with, the really checkered past of your newsletter with respect to intellectual property, if you know what I'm saying.
It's not intellectual property. It's stealing from a rabbi. I was raised conservative.
Stealing intellectual property from a rabbi.
Anyway, I was at, you caught me in the middle saying something nice about you, which is the non-zero. Oh, non-zero has this ringing tone, and it has actually a rather masculine tone to it. So I can imagine an action movie being called Non-Zero.
I like that voice. You should non-zero. Do trailer voices. That was good.
Mm-hmm. In a world where only one newsletter can survive.
This time
small
it's positive
potatoes
sum.
Bites the dust.
There we go. Boy, how could people not sign on for the paid version coming?
It's so weird. It's so weird. I mean, why don't they, you would think they would go ahead and become paid subscribers to both just as a kind of homage.
In case one of our systems goes down, they could just kind of move to the other.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like AT&T and T-Mobile kind of.
Yeah.
Not exactly. Okay, so what else are we going to talk? We're going to talk about the evil thing. White Lotus, big time, because we've now watched the whole thing.
And the incest references have become clear.
Everything's clear, and I have views on White Lotus, and I want to hear yours. It's a significant cultural event.
You do a Parker Posey imitation, Lorazepam. I can't.
Yeah, it's a good. I like the accent. It's a kind of Southern accent that I have heard before. Some people think it's too much, but
it is not.
Yeah,
you know,
weather
sexy.
Things. What?
It is not. It is fairly sexy.
You found it sexy?
I did.
I was raised around Southern accents, so it's less exotic to me.
Piper, no. Anyway.
Well, folks, in overtime, Paul will do some more of his Parker Posey imitation. Among other things. Thank you to everybody. Yeah, you can go to Non-Zero or Small Potatoes and become a paid subscribers if you want to hear the rest of the frivolity. If not, thanks for listening this far. And here we go.